Hellenistic and Roman Philosophy, Part 3, the 19th talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 17, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 7 in this series.
Okay, we've been talking about Hellenistic and Roman philosophy. We looked at Cynicism, and we've looked at Stoicism, almost finished Stoicism. Make a couple of final comments about Stoicism. Then we'll go on to Epicureanism and Skepticism and Neopythagoreanism. Stoicism, as you recall, just to review, Cynicism basically sees the problems of human existence as human institutions, human beings and human institutions. That if we could just get rid of the humanity of our existence and go back to living like the animals in keeping with nature, just go back and live in keeping with nature, we'd be fine. Let's get rid of all the institutions that human beings have created. That's the primary message of Cynicism. Stoicism is saying that what really is upsets our lives is our passions. We desire things, we want things, we expect things, and we tie our happiness to those things. If we just didn't want them, then we would be fine. So they're trying to transcend their desires and their longings and their wants, and that virtue they call apatheia, to be without passions, to be void of passions. And if we could just be void of passions, that's going to make our lives and our existence go better. Now, Stoicism, as we saw, is much more complicated than that. There's a whole cosmology. They believe in eternal recurrence. They believe in living according to nature, but they don't mean the same thing the cynics do. They have a sophisticated notion of living according to nature is to live in keeping with the logos, the very rational structure of reality. It's not unlike what later in the history of ideas becomes natural law. So live according to the natural laws, and then life will go better for you. So they strive to do that. I mentioned they believe in eternal recurrence, that this same reality, exactly the same reality, gets repeated over and over and over again without end. A couple of things we haven't touched on yet. When we get to their theory of knowledge, they begin to introduce some different ways of thinking about knowledge that were not there in Aristotle and Plato, and this becomes very important to preparing for the modern world. They deny the existence of universals, and you see how radical that is. Plato and Aristotle are all about universals. There's tables, but then there's tableness. That's what's ultimately real. That's what's eternal. That's what's incorruptible, are these ideas, these concepts that are that inform the particular things in this world, but they are not themselves particular things. They are universal things. Well, they gave actual being to the universals, right? It's not just the table that exists. It's tableness that exists. And not only did they give being to it, they gave a greater kind of being to that than to the table. Tables come and go. You know, I can take a blowtorch and a sledgehammer to this and make it not a table in no time. But I can't do that to tableness. Tableness is there to stay. It's permanent. It's eternal. It's fixed. The particulars are just a fleeting, temporary kind of manifestation of forms of being. But they barely exist at all because they could not exist very easily. Whereas the universals have real existence, real being.
This is Plato.
That's Plato and Aristotle. Okay. Now the Stoics come along and they reverse that. Tables are what exist. Tableness doesn't exist at all. The universals have no existence. So notice what they're saying. Now, it's not like you can't talk about tableness. You can talk about it, but what kind of being does tableness have? Well, it's an invention of the human mind. Or what they like in the Middle Ages, what they're going to say is the universal is a nomen, a name. It's only a name. So it's something that we human beings have created in and through human language to be able to group a bunch of things together. So I can talk about tableness and have it be a label that attaches to this table and that 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 table. But what actually exists in reality, what actually has been, not what the name names. The name is just a convenient practical device linguistically to be able to group things in my mind. But it's not like it has any existence or any being. The only thing that has existence and being is the particular table itself. That exists. See how modern that's sounding? That begins with the Stoics. Kind of skips over the Middle Ages, although in the late Middle Ages, there is a whole group of theologians called nominalists. And the nominalists are the people who take up this Stoic perspective and begin to introduce that into the church and into Christianity, that they begin to deny the existence of universals in favor of only particulars. God did not create universals. God only created particulars is what they will say. So knowledge, of course, is going to be different then for the Stoics, because whereas in Plato and Aristotle, as I observe, examine, see a table, what is my mind doing? Eventually my mind is abstracting from the particular existing table. It's abstracting the idea or the concept that really exists, abstracting tableness from the table. And that's what knowledge is my mind grasping, containing, having the tableness of the table. And that's why I understand the table, because I understand what it is. And that's my knowledge of the table. Whereas for the Stoic, or later in the Middle Ages, the nominalist, for them, knowledge is simply a matter of knowing a bunch of particulars. That's perceiving them with my senses. I have a sense experience, direct contact with particular tables, and that's really all knowledge is. And then when I group similar perceptions together, I come up with a name for what they seem to share in common, tableness. But that's just me. You know, that's just that's just giving myself a handle to use for grouping things together. But it doesn't actually exist. And so I don't really know it as if I am understanding reality. To understand reality is to understand particular things and only particular things. Any questions on that?
Well, let me help me with the name, then I can sound smarter. The philosopher's name that thinks that that the human brain that everything is just mapped out on the human brain. Reality is mapped out on the human brain.
Well, it could be several. John Locke is the first one in modern times to be. David Hume follows him.
Okay. All right, so my question is, the philosopher David Hume speaks about having reality already mapped out on the human brain, where the human brain is made to kind of conceive of the reality that he encounters. And that's, so the reality that he encounters, I don't know what you would call it, it's kind of fleeting, so to speak, but It exists as long as he's encountering it, and it maps out on his, it's ready to meet his mind.
Now, when you say mapped out, do you mean copied onto?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, copied onto, thank you.
Yeah.
So that reminded me, is this the Stoics, where they're saying that the mind grasps knowledge of the table as particular and they deny the existence of the universals. Is that related to the Hume idea of reality?
Yeah, I think undoubtedly. Now, I'm not enough of a Hume scholar or a Locke scholar to know, is there an explicit connection that we can discover through their writings? I'm not sure, but there's too big of a coincidence for there not to be that kind of connection. Notice my next point, or the third point down. The soul is a tabula rasa. That's exactly what Locke says, and Hume following him. That means a blank slate. Locke popularized in the modern era the idea that really, here's how knowledge works. The mind starts off a completely blank slate. We know nothing. I know nothing. It's a completely blank slate, and then all of a sudden things start coming in my eyes. And I have these sense perceptions that come in my eyes. And when they come in my eyes, they make an, I'm going to use Hume's language, not Locke's language, because Hume kind of refined it. They leave an impression on this tabula rasa. And basically what he's arguing is my mind photocopies that impression. That makes it an idea. So, and the idea is kind of filed away in the archives of the mind. And so whenever we know anything, all we're doing is filing through the file cabinets of our mind and finding that idea that corresponds to some impression, one or more impressions that we've had sometime during our life. Now, that's called radical empiricism, because what he's saying is that at root, all knowledge comes only from sense experience and nothing else. All it is a registering of what's gone across our senses and our sense experience. There's no part of my knowledge or in no sense that my knowledge is anything other than that. Now, Hume contradicts himself like crazy, it seems to me, but that's what he's trying to argue. And that's exactly the Stoics' concept of the soul as a tabula rasa. So I can't help but think that they've read the Stoics and borrowed that from them. The same thing with the Stoics are empiricists. All knowledge is derived from sense perception. That empiricism is coming from the Stoics as well. And knowledge is based on a memory remaining in the soul after perception. That's Hume's ideas corresponding to his impressions, that memory remaining behind. So I think the modern empiricist, and if we ever get there, we'll look at them, but I think all of those modern empiricists are heavily influenced by the Stoics' concept of knowledge. And just because we might not ever get there, notice what a problematic concept of knowledge it is. Imagine, try to tell the story of how a child ever learns anything. According to them, all a child could possibly have, if they could even have this, all a child could possibly have would be a collage of colored patterns going across his field of vision day in and day out. Wouldn't know what part of those patterns belong to one object rather than another object. I mean, maybe over time they could see parts of the patterns that seem to stick together and decide, well, maybe that's an object, but why would you assume that? Don't you have to have a belief in order to even think that there's some order to that collage of colors that I'm seeing? I mean, your mind, no wonder they sleep so much. you would wear out your cotton picking mind trying to figure out now what on earth is going on. But they're able to do that because they already know a bunch of stuff. And psychologists now begin to say they even know things like the basic fundamental shape of a mother's face. That's already an innate part hardwired into the human brain. So they're immediately alerted to that when they see it because, there's that pattern again. That's an important pattern. They're ready to tune in on that because it's hardwired into them. Well, that's knowledge. That didn't come from sense experience. That came from reason or intelligence itself. But if you read any of the child psychologists, it's fascinating what they've discovered that children already know before they know anything at all. That they can't possibly have gained it from culture because it's already operating before culture has a chance to even impact them.
So the problem with the Stoics, the problem with the modern empiricists is with regard to what they know is if you start with a blank slate, you just got nothing to start with. I mean,
exactly.
there's no starting point.
A blank slate would stay blank.
Yeah, you can't put together the pieces if you don't have any starting place at all to do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that...
I guess, first question, do any modern scientists really believe in total empiricism? Because like you said, the psychologists
Not really.
And stuff.
Not really.
It seems like science refutes that pretty well right now.
The people who believe it are philosophers who've just decided that, you know, Hume is their patron saint. Members of the local atheist club who are not themselves practicing scientists, but they fancy themselves as being scientific. But what they don't realize is it's 18th century science that they're committed to, not any modern science. But no practicing. The book to read in that regard, the death knell, as far as I'm concerned, to empiricism, is Personal Knowledge by Michael Polanyi. He was a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, Hungarian Jew, I assume, but I'm not sure about that. He wrote a book called Personal Knowledge where he basically talks about how there is no meaningful distinction to be made between objective and subjective. That what he argues is that all knowledge is a judgment by a person. A person has to make a judgment. When you read Hume, you see that all over the place. He'll talk about how we have these perceptions, and because of the similarity between perceptions, we group them. Who's we? I mean, according to his theory, they should just group themselves because there's no me to be grouping them. There's no mind in there. So his mind works as a blank slate because he's got all kinds of little gremlins up there doing all the work. All these little intelligent, rational gremlins who put things together, compare them, they're similar, dissimilar, next to each other, not next to each other, and so on. Who's making all those judgments? The gremlins. The mind is not, he says, so it must be the gremlins. But he can't possibly be, he's not even close to a consistent radical empiricist because he's got the brain doing all kinds of operations that require rational judgment.
Yeah.
And what he's trying to do is to say, well, there's no rational judgment going on. There's just this passive process of receiving perceptions and they get organized in a particular way, and that's where we get our ideas.
Okay. Because from what I understand of psychology, the child comes with a certain inbuilt amount of innate knowledge, but there's also phases and things like that. So when I took a psychology class, we talked about how a bunch of experiments demonstrate that kids that are of a certain age, if you put them on one side of the table and you're on the other side, and there's something in the middle of the table, they assume that you are seeing what they're seeing the way that they're seeing it from their side of the table, rather than if it looks different on your side, they don't really have that kind of perception to recognize, oh, this person sees something different from what I see. And so it's at a different developmental stage, not that far along, but where they begin to make certain differentiations, which is attributed, I think, both to the reasoning process and to just the development of the brain. So my next question is, I mean, we keep on talking about forms and universals and particulars, and I understand to some extent that it could have ramifications. It's just that when I hear kind of the dichotomy, it sounds like, you know, the ones who believe in forms, you know, these are like, you know, the people who are on God's side or something like that, and the ones who believe in, you know, particulars without universal forms, you know, these are, you know, the modern day atheists and stuff like that. And I see that, sure, I mean, a modern day atheist might believe in particulars or something like that because they don't assume, you know, some kind of creative mind in the first place. But it just doesn't seem as big of a deal to me. And I don't know if I'm missing your tone wrong, but you seem to be making...
Well, I do think ultimately the ramifications are pretty significant. I don't really care if somebody wants to fancy themselves an empiricist. I mean, I'm not going to consign them to hell for that.
Not so much the empiricism, but is that the same thing as the particulars?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the ramification, is that really if you reject the universals, where else can you go except where the Stoics go? Because if you're asking what exists and you've denied that the forms exist, all that's left are the particulars. And if you're saying, and the particular, now there are probably degrees to which people will do this, but if you're then saying, and those particulars, there's no real thing in them or a part of them or real thing that's an aspect of them that transcends them and has an existence independently of them in any sense, then all you can do is say all that exists are particulars.
Yeah, but can you believe in particulars and still believe that you're born with certain kinds of innate knowledge?
Oh, yeah.
Right, so that would...
Sure.
That means, right, that you can...
But what you can't... What you won't do, and I don't think what you can do, is accept that there's any kind of objectivity to the way we divide up the universe.
Okay.
It's going to have to be arbitrary. Mm-hmm. If the forms don't exist, then I made them up. And why didn't I make them up differently? Why did I have to make them up that way?
Mm-hmm.
Why do I group dogs as dogs and cats as cats? Why don't I group four-legged creatures as one kind of thing and two-legged creatures as another and call it good?
Don't they do that, though, with, like, phylum and kingdom and all that stuff? I mean, you have broad umbrella classifications working down to more and more specific classifications. And the way that you have a broad umbrella classification is if there is an attribute that goes pretty far across the board, like mammal or something like that. These are the mammals. But then you begin to break it down farther and farther into its particulars. And it seems like as you're categorizing these things, you're basing it on the attributes that they have,
right. The
characteristics that they have.
Right.
And so I don't see the same arbitrariness, because if you have a bunch of particulars and you see a pattern, you see a commonality among those particulars, your categorization of them might be a construct in your head, but it is a construct in your head that matches an actual pattern. And I think we could say that process happens without saying that there are these actual, like, somehow existing forms that are metaphysical in some way,
sure.
that then inform these items.
Yeah, and that's what the nominalist would say. I mean, they're not just saying we're rational about the way we name things.
Mm-hmm.
We really are trying to capture things that really do have attributes they share in common and so on. The difference is, think of it this way. Say the kingdom... What's next? Family? Phylum? Kingdom, phylum, family, etc., etc. Say that I lay out that schema. Does that schema represent something that I discovered that's actually there? Or is it just something that I have invented that, hey, it works for me?
Well, it seems like the way that you're choosing to systematize things is something that you are choosing to do.
Okay, then you're anomalous.
But the basis of your systematizing is something that actually exists.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. But see, the Aristotelian wants to go a step further, or the Kantian, or
okay,
they want to go a step further. The scheme itself is actually existing in nature, and I can actually be wrong or right about how I've created my schema. Anomalist would not say your schema is wrong or right. It just is what it is. Whereas the Aristotelian is going to say, you either have it right or you have it wrong. Mm-hmm. Being is structured this way or being is not structured this way.
And the schema exists metaphysically, the forms exist metaphysically. So you have, you know, this world, and then you have a bunch of forms, you know, somewhere on the edge of this world or beyond this world or something.
Where in the nature of the forms is debatable.
Okay. Yeah, you're probably positing they're in God's mind.
In his purpose, his mind.
Or his purpose, some right. Weird metaphor like that.
And if you don't believe that, you're going to hell.
I can't believe the nominalists, because they're always arguing about classification. I mean, if it's... I mean, you don't argue... Yeah.
I was saying that scientists can't really be nominalists because they're always arguing their classifications. And if they really thought it was just names that they gave things, it wouldn't matter that they were right or wrong, or whether the three-toed sloth belongs with the orangutan or whether they belong, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, they think that there is really a real way that things should be grouped, and maybe they're wrong in their premises about why they think it should be grouped that way, but they obviously do think that there is a right way to have things figured out, so.
I mean, I don't know, it's just, take redheads, okay, there's a certain amount of human beings that are redheads. And so I categorize them as redheads, but there's different shades of red. So I create classifications based on shades of red. It just seems weird to me that metaphysical forms would have to exist when I can clearly look at particulars and arrive at certain classifications of these different redheads just by examining those particulars. And so, I don't know, Occam's razor or something, creating these metaphysical forms that then necessitate the informing of the redheads seems superfluous.
Okay.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around it, though.
You're anomalous.
That's right. I guess I'm anomalous. I've never taken that name before, but it sounds kind of cool. It has a lot of consonants in it and a lot of alliteration, nominalist. Okay.
Yeah. No, and that would be the sort of, in fact, Occam was a nominalist, and that's his argument. I mean, among other things. But what it comes down to is the issue that I raised just a second ago. It ultimately comes down to, though, am I discovering what is, or am I imposing my scheme on what is? And that's where it becomes important. Now, where does that be... Is there any relevance to that law? Absolutely. I mean, look at the debate going on right now about gay marriage and just in behind that, homosexuality itself. Is our propensity to think of heterosexuality as normal, is that just something, a scheme that we have imposed upon reality? That's what everybody in modern society says. Fundamentally, or are we looking at something that is actually built into the way things are? Is it objectively real? Is it an objective? Is it an objective reality that we can discover, or is it a arbitrary convention that we have invented? That would be a nominalist answer to that question. As opposed to an objectivist answer, a realist, that's the word used in the Middle Ages, a realist answer to that question.
If you
try not to go on a key tangent here, but regarding forms, then, in this particular case, there would be a form of heterosexuality, but there would also be some kind of a form of homosexuality that's informing the homosexual as well, right? Because homosexuality then wouldn't be anti-form. It would have a form, and it would be being informed by a form.
I don't think Aristotle or Plato would ever argue that an action or a choice has a form attached to it. It's only
objects, nouns. But don't we categorize things like verbs? You know, we categorize different verbs as based on their similarities as well. So it would seem like logically, if you begin with the presupposition of forms, you would have to extend the forms to not only the nouns, but also to the verbs, also to the adjectives.
Right. No, I don't think you'd have to. I mean, certainly Aristotle and Plato don't.
Okay.
See, the fact of the matter is, when it comes to language, the nominalists are clearly right about some linguistic elements.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of linguistic elements are just, this is the way we do it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the name we use. This is the... And that may actually be true about some of the words we use about things. So there's a nominalist use of language, and there's a realist use of language. And I think in our actually ordinary speech, we combine both of them. We use both, sometimes one, sometimes the other.
I'll think about it some more.
Okay, the only other thing, just so we move on here, to say about Stoicism is I think I commented about they had a really very religious and pious devotion to the one, which was the Logos. And they had a very pious flavor to the way they lived their lives. And indeed, they practiced and believed in divination and oracles like crazy. They were madly superstitious about signs and omens and all kinds of divination and oracles and that kind of stuff. So that's the Stoics.
In any sense, a universal.
No, because it was unique. So if a universal is something that sums up a bunch of particulars, the one is not summing up a bunch of particulars. It's an absolutely unique being. And the one for them is not a person. It's the Logos for them is impersonal and material. It's an impersonal, material being that infuses itself throughout the cosmos. Okay, that's Stoicism, as best I can represent it to you. And I will move on unless there's any final questions on Stoicism. Okay, now we turn to Epicureanism. Okay, for the Cynics, human culture was the problem. For the Stoics, passion is the problem. For the Epicureans, the problem is the gods, and especially our fear of the gods. Life will go so much better if we can just stop being afraid of the gods. Now, you can imagine what kind of thing Epicurus is, the founder of this school. That's where the name comes from. The Epicureans are follower of Epicurus. Epicurus, in his context, was undoubtedly aware of... I mean, the Romans had thousands of gods. And the Greeks are not too far behind. I mean, by the time you get to the Romans, though, they have thousands of gods, and they are making offerings to a variety of different household gods and civic gods and national gods, and I mean, they're just worshiping every god all the time, covering their bases. The Greeks were very much like that as well. They want to make sure that all the relevant gods are kept happy, because if the gods are not kept happy, your life, they may get angry with you, and they're not going to be on your side. And they're going to do some mean, nasty things toward you and in your life, and you don't want that. So you fear them, and out of that fear, you worship them, you offer offerings to them. Well, Epicurus is basically saying, what a waste of time and emotional energy. If we could just get that out of our lives, get that aspect of human existence out of our lives, life would go so much better. So he spends his time trying to argue that he doesn't actually argue, Epicurus doesn't argue that the gods don't exist. But basically what he says is, dude, the gods are up there partying, totally zoned out on ambrosia. I mean, they're just as happy as can be. They could care less about you. They are not at all interested in you, one way, either positively or negatively. They're not thinking about you. So whatever gods are up there, don't worry about them. That's not what you have to worry about. That's his fundamental message. And in terms of the therapeutic value of Epicurean philosophy, it's remedying that fear of the gods that seems to consume us and drive us and preoccupy us. His most famous disciple was a Roman, was a later Roman named Lucretius, who wrote a famous poem on the nature of things. Was the poem, a long epic poem kind of thing, and it basically tells the story of the beginning of the universe. And Epicurus taught that Democritus, and if you remember Democritus, he was the pre-Socratic who advocated atomism. Everything is, the whole world is an infinite number of little atoms. And before anything existed, all the atoms were just flying through the void. And then there was this big traffic jam collision. And they all collided into each other and began to collect and aggregate and form objects, and a world came out of that. And a world, not only a world, but basically what our cosmos was the result of that collision because of a big swerve in the multiplicity of atoms as they fell through the void. So there are no gods. All there are atoms, Lucretius says. And the world is just the collection of these atoms acting like atoms. That's all there is. Very modern. I mean, that's basically the natural, in a nutshell, the naturalistic worldview that surrounds us today. Matter and energy is all there is. There ain't no more.
Just the bolt of lightning has to strike the right mud puddle.
Right. Get it started. Yep. The other distinctive doctrine of Epicureanism is the role of pleasure. They were hedonists, and a hedonist is somebody who believes that pleasure is some kind of ultimate good or has some kind of primacy in terms of what the good is. For Epicurus, he saw pleasure and pain as basically epistemological tools. I know what is good by what is pleasurable, and I know what is evil by what is painful. So it becomes a part of my toolbox for gaining knowledge. I can see things, I have all my sense experience, but overlaying all of my sense experiences, if something results in pleasure, that gives me moral knowledge of that thing. I have the moral knowledge that that's in keeping with the good. And if it causes pain, results in pain, then I have moral knowledge that that's evil, in keeping with what's evil. So that's his hedonism. When it comes down to his ethics, Epicurus was not a wild... What we think of as a hedonist is a partying, indulgent, wild, drunk, orgiastic type lifestyle. Epicurus was very moral. In fact, he was famous. He was famous for his piety and morality and goodness. Everyone who knew him respected him for being a truly good man. So how do you put that together with being a hedonist? Because, like I said, hedonism for him is just a device for moral knowledge. Pleasure indicates goodness. But he had the sense to realize that intense, short-term, immediate pleasure is not necessarily the best kind of pleasure. So he tended to make a distinction between the intense, short-term pleasures of a shot of heroin or sexual ecstasy or something like that, that, okay, that's pleasurable, but what follows the pleasure? Then what? In some cases, guilt or depression or something else. So you weigh those together, and he says, that's not good. That's not a pleasure that lasts. It's not a pleasure that can sustain itself. It's not a pleasure that's a good pleasure. I mean, a good kind of pleasure as opposed to a bad kind of pleasure. So he weighs the nature of the pleasure as part of his moral knowledge and his moral judgment. So he ends up thinking that the pleasure-pain principle ends up advocating intellectual pleasures over bodily pleasures, lasting pleasures over short-term pleasures, and so on. So where that leads him is to a very rational, moral, good life. And that's what he advocated. So remember, we've noticed several times, what is an Epicurean today in our modern language? A very sensual person. Wine, music, aesthetics. Really getting into the sensuality of aesthetics. That's an Epicurean, and having a very well-developed taste for various aesthetic pleasures. That's not Epicurus. Sensuality would be among the last of the pleasures that he would give much credence to and much credit to as a source of moral knowledge.
Sorry. Does Epicurus only consider the pleasure or pain to the self or to the other as well?
As far as I know, it's to myself. It's my tool for making moral judgment. He's not a utilitarian. That will come later. The first famous utilitarian was considered a hedonistic utilitarian. And his whole principle was you should do that which maximizes the pleasure for the most number of people. That's Jeremy Bentham, and he's called a hedonistic utilitarian. But no, that's not Epicurus, to my knowledge. I don't think he ever said anything like that.
So I don't think it's fair to call what you're calling today's Epicureans as Epicureans. It doesn't sound like they have anything in common with Epicurus, because he considered the consequences of his action and weighed it all out. What you're saying today is not that. So the only thing they had in common with him is they don't believe in God. Or they don't believe God should have any kind of way in as their choices.
Yeah, I think that's true. And the fact that there's a certain priority given to pleasure, but the priority that's given to pleasure is different in Epicurus than it is in an Epicurean today. But because there's some kind of priority to pleasure, that's where the name comes from, I think.
I can see.
But Epicurus, like the Stoics, tended to emphasize sense experience as the basis for all knowledge. So all knowledge and reason is ultimately based on sense experience. So he tends toward empiricism much like the Stoics did. Okay. I think I've covered him. Any questions on Epicurus? When you read, I was just reading Calvin for class these days, and he refers to the Epicureans a couple of times. For Calvin, to be an Epicurean is to be an atheist. It's his denial of the gods that's the most distinctive feature of the Epicureans for him. Okay?
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
So the Epicureans, let's just talk about Epicurus. He was a very moral man. So when you take a person like Epicurus who lives his life very morally, and you take a Jew who also lives a life, a very moral life, both each person's living a moral life, but each person has to be having a different reason for living that moral life. I assume that the Jew would be living the moral life out of love and honor of God. Mm-hmm. Why does Epicurus live his moral life?
A conviction that my life will go better if I do.
Is he? He can't be thinking he's pleasing something or a god.
No.
Or does he just believe in karma?
No.
What is it that's going to bring him all this goodness his way if he acts morally?
Less turmoil in my own soul, less turbulence there, a calmer life. Not unlike the reason a Buddhist lives a good life. It's really about my conviction, my belief, that that's the way to get through life in a better way, in a healthier, more satisfying way.
So does he actually think that he's like warding off disease doing that?
No.
Or that he would just accept the disease as part of life and, I don't know, what, live morally while he has a disease? What?
I think things like tragedy will tend to test an Epicurean, I think.
Yeah.
He lived to be an old man without a lot of infirmity, so I don't think it was all that tested. But, yeah, what are you going to do if you're living like an Epicurean and from the outside of your control, life...
The piano falls on your head.
Yeah. Or a roof tile.
Yeah, right. Or an anvil.
So do you think he would consider himself an agnostic or an atheist?
Epicurus himself, Lucretius seems to be more atheistic than in my recollection. I may be wrong about this, but my impression from what I've read about Epicurus is that he would be he's quite content to say, maybe the gods exist, yeah. But if they exist, they're not interested in you, so don't worry about it. So in that sense, an agnostic.
That makes him a deist? Divine clock, make your way out there where he doesn't care?
Well, no, because see, it's not, he didn't create, the gods did not create the world. They are a product of the creation of the world, if they exist at all. They too, in fact, I think he's pretty, he has to be, that the gods would be material as well. Because everything's made of atoms for the atomist and for the Epicurean.
The world created itself?
Yeah, there's this big swerve that caused this incredible collision that out of which popped the world.
Well,
you said it, not me.
When I ask the question agnostic or atheist, I'm asking about transcendent God, not some kind of weird Greek.
No, there is no transcendent God.
Well, the idea must have been out there. I mean, they must have considered the idea of a transcendent.
Not really. Well, not transcendent in the way that you get in. I mean, even the Jews, knowing God, having revealed to them, still kept bringing God back into this reality. The idea of transcendence is born of biblical Judaism and has to take a couple of running starts before it takes off. It doesn't fly immediately. I mean, by the time you get to the New Testament, it's a very well-formed idea, I think. And is very clearly understood by the Judaism of that day. But I don't think Abraham understood it. It's not really till Moses that God actually introduces the idea to Israel, and they still don't really get it. I mean, the idea that they build a golden calf at the foot of Mount Sinai, well, maybe we can worship Yahweh this way. You know?
But the Greeks must have batted that around, right?
Their gods are not the transcendent
Socrates?
God of the Bible.
Socrates?
Maybe Socrates. But see, he doesn't do theology, so it's hard to know what his conception of God was. He's not really speaking to that issue. So it's hard to know. But could be at some tacit level, Socrates may have had a more mature concept of God. Okay, let's do one more, because we can do it really fast. Skepticism, or what is typically called for centuries after that, Pyrrhoism, after Pyrrho of Elis, who is basically the father of ancient skepticism. The name comes from the distinctive doctrine that they are skeptical with respect to the possibility of knowing truth. Now, the critical thing to understand there is they're skeptical with respect to the possibility of knowing truth. They're not skeptical about the existence of truth or the concept of truth or the idea of truth. That's a very modern invention, and ancient skepticism knew no such skepticism about the concept of truth. They believed that there was an objective truth. I mean, everybody knows that. Sure, there's an objective truth. But how am I going to know what it is? My senses are not reliable. My reasoning is not reliable. The famous argument for all skeptics is the argument from illusion. I look down a railroad track, and it looks like the rails are converging, but they're not. So my eyes have tricked me. I stick the stick in the water, and it looks like the stick is bent, but it's not bent. That's an illusion. So see, you can't trust your senses. Now, all the arguments for skepticism are incredibly naive, because, well, how is it that we figured out that the stick wasn't bent? We also used our senses for that. I mean, yes, sense experience can create anomalous kinds of perceptions, that's true, but it's not like we're so dumb that we get faked out by them. We recognize them as anomalies. We recognize that my eyes are playing tricks on me, and we figure that out. So is knowledge possible through the senses? Apparently. We know the stick's not bent. So apparently my sense experience is adequate to be able to come to that knowledge. So it's kind of a silly argument, but it's a standard argument of the skeptics that, well, look there, that stick looks like it's bent in the water. You can't trust your senses. So there you go. But for them, not only can you not trust your senses, but you can't trust your thinking. But the better arguments they give are arguments about you come in from the cold and the room feels very warm. You come in from the freezer and exactly the same room seems... Wait, did I say that again? You come out of the sauna and exactly the same room seems cool. Well, how can the same room that's exactly the same temperature to one observer in one set of circumstances seem to the senses to be warm, and to another observer in a different situation seem cool? That are obviously our senses are misleading us. But again, look at the naivete of that. Don't we come through experience to realize if something feels cool, it's partly relative to my to what whether I was outside or in the sauna to start with? I mean, don't we understand that? We understand that. So my sense experience, what that tells us is that I can't take sense experience without making a judgment about it to gain knowledge. That's true. It's not, so to the radical empiricist, that's a problem. You know, to a David Hume, where the sense experience is all there is to my knowledge, which do I pick? Is the room cool or is the room warm? But if you allow judgment to be made and that's the basis of your knowledge, it's not a problem that we have different sense experiences in different circumstances.
Okay, could I argue time over?
Yeah, we'll have to stop shortly. We'll do a little bit more next week, but if it's a quick question, go ahead.
Just to be a skeptic for a moment, I'm going to say, Jack, when I'm talking about that stick being in the water, I'm just taking something simple that you can understand and pointing out how we can be easily misled. And what I'm doing is I'm just illustrating the fact that a more complex idea is something with a lot more to it. We can't trust our senses. So I would make that argument.
Okay. Okay. Well, if I remember, I'll respond to that next week. My short answer is that may very well be what they're doing. Interestingly, I have never read a more complex argument by a skeptic. But I don't think anyone is going to deny. I mean, it's not like they're making some profound point that's been lost on the rest of mankind who are not skeptics, that when issues are complicated, sometimes we make mistakes in our reasoning and mistakes in our conclusions and mistakes in our judgment. That, okay. But who's going to deny that? The biggest problem with skepticism is it points to the fallibility of human judgment and says then we cannot know. But why stop there? Yes, human knowledge is fallible. But the remarkable thing is, human knowledge is also self-correcting. It discovers its mistakes and fixes them. I mean, that's what's remarkable about human knowledge, is that it can know its own mistakes, can discover its own mistakes. That's how intelligent we are. That's how good it is. That's how competent our intellectual abilities are, is that even if we make a mistake, we can eventually identify our mistake and fix it.